Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, special guest, former Comptroller General of the United States, Charles Boucher, joins the roundtable. The SUCOM DC Talk for Super Committee is getting close to the two-minute warning. What could they possibly do to make both sides happy, and can the government win back the trust and faith of the people? Wall Street is drawing a line in the sand with the Democrats. Who could win the showdown? Hey, if it's Tuesday, that means there's a Republican debate. Want to hear a joke? Why did the chicken cross the road? Electrified border fence. This is Backroom Politics. Good afternoon, everybody. It's Tuesday, Black Nation Capital. That is the time for Back to Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio, live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital. It is America's premier cigar tavern, hosting America's premier cigar smoking political roundtable. You're welcome to join the discussion. Call us at 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. Joining me, as I do every Tuesday, to my left, he is the former eight-term member of Congress representing Washington's 2nd Congressional District. He's the former vice president of government affairs for Burlington Northern Railroad. He is the Honorable Congressman Al Swift.
How are you doing?
He is a former Senate staffer and former Undersecretary of Commerce. He has served under four presidential administrations. He is our resident pundit, actually the one we like best. He's the Honorable Alan Moore. Alan, welcome back.
I always appreciate being to the left of Al Swift.
To my 12 o'clock, he is the former staff, he's the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford, former vice president of the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, welcome.
Glad to be here as always.
And to my right, he is the vice president of the Eurasia Center. He is the vice president for China Affairs for the Eurasia Center. He is a bar-certified attorney in the District of Columbia and the great state of New York. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, welcome back.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And it is my honor and pleasure to introduce our special guest today. Joining us here in the smoke-encrusted nerve center of Backroom Politics, he is the former Comptroller General of the United States. He is the former Assistant Secretary of the Navy. He has served on various corporate boards. Longtime government insider. He is Chuck Boucher. Chuck, thanks for joining us. This is
really special.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Chuck, you know, I want to get right into asking you a couple of things. Now, you know, we've been talking about having, you know, we've got the former Comptroller General of the United States here. To us inside the Beltway, that's kind of a big deal. People in Des Moines, Iowa are going, okay, who's he? Tell us a little bit, as your role as Comptroller General, what was your functionality in the government at the time you were serving?
Well, actually, in 1921, they passed the Budget and Accounting Act of 1921, as it's called, and that meant that the Budget Bureau came out of the Treasury and went to the President. And when they were debating that law, why the Congress said we better get the auditors out and see how the money was really spent at the end of the fiscal year. And so the GAO was founded at that time and separated again from the Treasury. So that's what we are. We're basically at GAO, the auditor of the federal government, and we can review everything and anything except the CIA.
Everything except the CIA.
Yeah.
Wow. Because God knows they don't need oversight.
Right.
Now, obviously, when you were the Comptroller General, you actually headed up the organization when it was known as the Government Accounting Office.
That's right.
It is now since transitioned to become known as the Government Accountability,
Office. Right.
Was it just simply a name change, or did the functionality change as it went forward?
Yeah, it did change very little. It was more of a change of the name. Because, see, we really no longer was doing the accounting. That's changed in 1950 after World War II when they moved the accounting back to the executive branch. and we really became the auditing group at that time, and it's still really the auditing group.
Now, for those people inside the Beltway who have been watching or watching the news, watching the inside baseball politics, and actually a lot of the government contracting insiders, we've seen the functionality of the GAO become almost more investigative as far as fairness in government contracting. Is that an accurate representation of what the GAO does today?
Well, no. I would say that we've been doing that for a long, long time. And basically, any private sector company that's in a procurement with the government can protest if they think the process has been not followed properly. We never make a decision of whether airplane A is better than airplane B. But if you remember in the tanker contract that
right.
got protested, why the Air Force didn't really follow a very good procurement process, and so the GAO ruled in favor of the company that protested. Only about 15% of protests will get upheld.
Now, when we talk about federal regulations, you'll hear us refer to maybe in this discussion the FAR, the Federal Acquisition Regulations. Has the FAR become more pro-government, or is it more pro-business nowadays? Because we've seen some changes going on in the FAR even as recently as a few months ago.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I would say that they've been major changes, though. I think that the changes, are, again, technical and things like that. But I think today, if the government agency that's running the procurement runs a good procurement, the chances are the GAO will uphold that procurement. Which was a big surprise to me when the Air Force ran such a bad one on the tanker.
And now, inside, we're going to talk a little inside baseball for those of you who are not inside the Beltway who are listening. It does strike us that when we talk about defense acquisition procedures, defense acquisition processes and protocols, out of all of the government agencies, as many procurements, especially large-scale procurements as they do, such as the tanker acquisition, DOD has large, and the component agencies have largely been viewed as having the most mature process and the most mature protocols in place. Does it shock you, the fact that even nowadays, especially with the public and press scrutiny that they get, that they deviate from that a little bit?
It does surprise me. But I will say this, that for the most part, when you think of the thousands of procurements every year, the Defense Department does a pretty good job. It's really kind of a surprise sometimes when we see a big one. Like when I was there during my 15 years, we didn't overturn many of the big ones. And most of the defense big contractors really don't want to protest. They want to get along with the Defense Department, you know. But if they all of a sudden decide that, you know, it was really not properly run and there's a lot at stake, why, they will protest. You know.
Is the contracting community, do you find that they're using it more as a negotiating tool nowadays, the process of protesting, or do you think that they're still looking at it as a last-ditch effort to make things fair?
No, I think the last-ditch effort is probably a good description.
Very good.
Yeah.
Very good. Now, the one thing that strikes me about your time as serving as a Comptroller General, you served under two Republican presidents. You served under Reagan starting in 1981.
Yeah.
Flowed through to George Bush, 41.
That's right.
And then you also served under a Democrat, under Bill Clinton.
That's right.
As 42nd president.
Yeah.
Did you see, I mean, obviously GAO is a very nonpartisan, a very independent body. That is, dare I say, non-political.
Yeah. When you think about it, there's only one presidential appointment. It is the Comptroller General. Everybody else is a career person in there. And so it really is, comes as close, I think, as to any government agency being bipartisan, independent, in doing their job.
Interesting.
And if you think about it, it's not uncommon that in a 15-year term, you will serve when there's a change in party at the White House. So, you know, you got to be prepared for that.
Now, Alan, go ahead.
I just wanted to point out something, too, that the 15-year term for the Comptroller General suggests that both parties in the Congress pay very close attention to who they're going to give this kind of role and authority to for 15 years, and it speaks very well of Chuck that when he was nominated, he was confirmed by both houses for a 15-year term where everyone knew that he would be around a very long time.
Right. I mean, this is an individual who, you know, had to go through the scrutiny of having a speaker in Tip O'Neill, a Republican president in President Reagan, and Senate Majority Leader at that time would have been
Howard Baker.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that definitely crosses all partisan aisles.
Yeah.
That's an impressive state. Yeah. Let's talk about.
And I might also point out that in 1981, they changed the process slightly because of Congressman Jack Brooks from Texas, who wanted to get the House of Representatives in the front-end selection process. He always pointed out that the Senate confirms, the President appoints, but, you know, this is an official that basically works with the Congress in the congressional appropriation. You know, our appropriation is in the legislative appropriation. So he put a front-end on it where the five leaders of the House, the five leaders of the Senate form a temporary commission, and they have to send three or more names to the president. The president does not have to pick off that list to preserve the separation of power issue. But in my case, in 81, there was eight names sent to President Reagan, and I was selected by President Reagan. The systems worked pretty well since that front end was put on. And it, Alan points out what you say, the leadership of the Congress is involved in selecting this person.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and they get to ask you a lot of times to do certain things.
That's right.
You know, you talked about the contracting, and there's a whole other major role that the GAO plays, which is they will go in and have a look to see how a particular law is working. Is it doing what people thought it was going to do? There could be a political aspect to these requests, but just as a for instance that I happen to know something about, when President Bush did his big global AIDS program called PEPFAR, something I was quite involved in, there were some controversial individual aspects of it, and the GAO was asked to go to the field, and see how this program was functioning and whether some concerns that some people had about details of the program, whether they were interfering with the effectiveness. And it was a major GAO study that came out. It had nothing to do with contracting. It had everything to do with the law and how the law was being implemented.
And that actually brings up a really good point is, you know, in recent times, you know, we talk about PEPFAR and the GAO's response to that. We saw the GAO taking front and center stage with Obamacare and the ability for, you know, the legalities of Obamacare being implemented. Did that over-politicize the GAO, do you think, or do you think it maintained independence?
No, I think that's very much the role. See, if you go back to 1950, when they did the Budget and Accounting Act of 50, moved the accounting back to the executive branch, and now we were the auditors, they were still doing basically financial audit, but my predecessor, Elmer Stotz, was asked to look at LBJ's war on poverty programs. How well were they working, see? And so he gradually moved us into more and more evaluating the program. And like one of the ones I always sometimes use in illustration was the B-1 bomber.
Right.
In other words, here was a bomber that could fly when they got done building it, right?
Right.
But the software on the defensive system and the software on the offensive system was not working. So you had an airplane that had a pilot and a co-pilot. You had an offensive guy looking at screens, no window at all in the plane, and a defense, see? And so the missile could be coming at that plane, and if he can't see it on his screen, the plane is in trouble.
Right.
And if he can't shoot it accurately, the plane isn't very, you see. So we issued a report that pointed out these problems, see? Well, the Air Force, they thought, you know, they raced a few generals to the Today Show in the morning to explain that, you know, the B-17 had a few problems, but then in the World War II, we fixed the problems. And yeah, well, that was easy because all you did was bend metal in 1940. but now in software, see. So those are the kind of issues you get into. And, you know, there's no question that everybody really has a strong opinion on a program, whether it should go forward or not go forward. Right now, you've got a big decision being made, I think, on the Joint Strike Fighter, and the Marines have their version of it, and it's going to be a very costly follow-on to the Harrier plane, see. And so if we do have to make cuts in the defense budget, will that one be
one of the sacrificial lambs
that
they put up?
Yeah.
It's actually one of the things we're going to talk about under the super committee discussion here in a second. But I want to talk to you a little bit. You also served from 67 to 71 as Assistant Secretary of the Navy.
That's right.
When you look at, obviously, you had an insider's view of DOD at the time, and obviously you've kept your finger on the pulse of DOD since. Is the state of defense now, and namely our warfighters, whether they be soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen, Coasties, are we in a better situation now than we were, let's say, when you were in the Pentagon, or are we facing a real trouble right now in our defense strategy?
Well, I would say that the fighting forces were really good when I was there because we've been in Vietnam fighting for quite a while. The same now. So the guys that are over there, you know, really doing the fighting, they're right up to speed. The problem you got is that the cost of these wars, just like the cost of the Vietnam War, is huge. And the question is it worth the effort to have a war where, you know, a guy can walk on an IUD and get his legs blown off by a $100 or maybe even a $10 device? And I saw in the 60-minute program today, we've got, you know, 120,000, 30,000 troops there. The Marine General was saying we only have 50 Al-Qaeda people left in Afghanistan, and just less than 10,000 Taliban. So, you know, it seems like a very costly, both in manpower and injuries and everything like that. And so that's going to, again, when we have these kind of deficits, that's going to be a big issue.
When we see the 60 Minutes piece, one you mentioned this past Sunday,
yeah.
and we saw the ambassador and the general
right.
talking about why our presence there is needed. It almost invokes Charlie Wilson's mentality that we spent all this time, all this money to get Russia out of Afghanistan, and then we just pulled the plug and we screwed up the end game. Do we not learn from history? Is this something that we've got to look at and say, look? And it seems like the ambassador and the general are sitting there saying, hey, look, we saw what happened back in the mid-80s. We can't afford to have that again, or else we're going to do the same thing 20 years down the road. Do you agree with Charlie Wilson's mentality as we cannot screw the end game up in Afghanistan this time?
I don't necessarily agree with Charlie Wilson's
mentality. Why is that?
The late, great, infamous Charlie Wilson.
But the truth of the matter is, I never thought. I served under McNamara, Clifford, and Laird. And
mm-hmm.
3 years was under Laird. I was carried over into the Nixon administration. And we really had to work hard for 4 years to extract ourselves from that war situation. And I can remember when Clifford made the decision not to give Westmoreland his request for 200,000 more troops. That was the beginning of the American trying to lower our involvement in the jungle. And I remember one of the Marine generals, Major General, who had been Westmoreland, one of his top staff people, came to me and said, you know, we'll take a million easy if we really want to prevail over there. And I think the American people just don't want to put a million and spend that kind of money.
Congressman Al.
This is a very high-level discussion, and I hate to bring it down to something, but probably the average American gets more upset about $800 hammers and $700 toilets and things like that. And I once had a Navy guy explain to me that the way they did that is they'd go out and in one, he didn't use the term, purchase order, they'd buy 1,000 hammers and 2 battleships. And then the way they did it, they divide it by 1,002. And so you had $800 hammers and $800 battleships. Is that an accurate representation of what goes on when we end up with
seats? No, I wouldn't think that is too accurate. But there's no question that the cost estimate on a lot of this stuff, and when we're buying some of that small stuff, is lots of times it's not done the most cost-effective way and everything like that. But I think the public does get upset when they read about those situations, no question about it.
Is there any reason they shouldn't?
No, there's no reason why they shouldn't. I mean, the cost of wars are really expensive. That's where, if you think of what happened to Europe from 1914 to 1945, where they went from great countries to being bankrupt and practically destroyed all of Europe in two wars. Wars are very, very costly and very, and everybody goes into them thinking it's going to be a short war, right? And Mrs. Thatcher had a short war. She picked a great one down there in the Balkans. Yeah, and it made her, the Iron Lady and everything like that. Most people, like the Kaiser, you know, in 1914, or the people that got us into this Middle East war now, this 10-year war, they didn't expect it to be a 10-year war.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we're going to get into the program schedule. We're going to talk about what's going on with the Super Committee and some of the insights of our roundtable on what they're hearing. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room in Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us. Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics. on Blog Talk Radio. We're here with the usual gang of thugs and our special guest, Chuck Bowser, former Comptroller General of the United States. And we're going to talk a little bit now about the Super Committee and what's going on with the Super Committee. For those of you who do not know, we are getting close to the November 23rd deadline, which they have to produce $1.2 trillion in deficit reductions. The question is this too much of a feat for the Super Committee to undertake, or can they actually pull this off and make everybody happy? I want to start with you, Bob. Is this too much? Are they taking too big of a bite of this apple, Bob? Is this realistic?
Well, first I would say that if you're serious about trying to reduce the budget, it isn't nearly big enough by probably a factor of three. It's about one-third big enough at the most. But that said, this it may be as big as they can get. I think it's probably likely that getting that far is going to be very difficult. I think the most useful thing that has happened so far is that there are no leaks from the committee, which means that they are serious about what they're doing, and they recognize that they can't put out pieces of it and have everybody shoot at it. They've got to have a package which they come forward with, and when they do that, let's hope that it's at least 1.2, between 1.2 maybe and closer to 1.5. But your question is it enough? And the answer is it's not really enough to make a dent in the deficit.
Congressman Al.
Let me quibble with the way you asked the question. Can they do it and make everybody happy? I think the trick is if they do it at all, they've got to make everybody unhappy in equal amounts.
Well, it does beg the question, though, and Chuck, I'll pose this question to you. You kind of been in tune with some of the goings-on inside the Super Committee. Are you getting the sense that maybe that $1.2 trillion, it may not be enough, but it's enough to at least kind of soothe the sleeping beast a little bit? Or why haven't they invoked Simpson-Bowles as the baseline for what they should be able to do? Something that, by the way, everybody in Congress kind of went, yeah, okay, I can kind of live with that.
Well, the big thing is, you know, as everyone knows, it's really, the question is, are you going to have any revenue enhancements, sometimes known as taxes, as part of the solution? And if you don't, it's hard to get to those numbers without really taking a big whack at the feds. And so I really think that the contest here in this committee effort is can they get people to go along with some tax increases or changes in the exemptions and deductions, something that gives you some part of the solution that way, or if not, it seems to me they're forced back into the defense area, and a lot of people are not going to. So I agree with the congressman here. You're going to make a few people equally unhappy if you're going to get like that. I mean, the discretionary part, you know, you're going to make some cuts there for sure.
Right.
Like in these agriculture things. But, you know, the fascinating thing is that they're talking about 10-year numbers here. George Shultz, his name was on there, pointing out that, you know, this Congress will be gone in 6 months after they get this report. And so in the old days, when I worked on some of the financial crisis in New York City and Chrysler and everything like that, you tried to get on top of the problem right now. And, you know, and today, they're floating $40 billion in new bonds in one day. The biggest deficit we had before 81 was a $25 billion deficit in the Vietnam War period, just before Johnson put in surtax. So my own feeling is you can't do it just on the spending side. You got to do it on the revenue side as well as the spending side.
Well, you know, in considering that aspect of it, you know, going back to the defense approach side of it, I mean, that seems to be a third rail with most of the Republican Party on the Hill right now.
Yeah.
And Alan, I'll go with you on this one. Our friends over at Politico, namely Jake Sherman, had a piece in Politico the other day saying that House Republican leaders are getting ready and just kind of bracing the Republican leadership of saying, hey, this may not be good. Can they sell defense cuts to an already stretched-thin Defense Department on the Hill.
What they can sell if it's handed to them is a broad-based, ding everybody kind of a proposal. And we don't know whether $1.2 trillion, $1.5 trillion, $2.5 trillion, $4.3 trillion is being talked about because, as Bob says, and this is rather surprising around here, no leaks. 12 people participating, investing enormous amounts of time, no leaks. We also know that the two co-chairs, Patty Murray and Jeb Hensarling, are getting along remarkably well. They're in public talking. They seem to have a lot of respect for each other. These are all very good things. Having said that, this is a very, very tight time horizon, and they don't want to fail. They don't want to. Failure is coming up with less than $1.2 trillion. That's what they are legislatively required to achieve. What we're still hoping for is something more than that, because we know so much more has to be done to solve the problem. But if a group comes out of there with you have to have at least 7 votes, 7 out of the 12, to require that both houses give it an up or down vote. If we could come out of there with something with 8 or 9 votes, I think it would have a very good chance of being sold, because everyone understands that everybody had to give, and this is a really difficult thing to do.
And I would say that you practically have to have 8 votes, because you got to get one on each side, don't you think, to break?
If it would be unusual to have 6 of 1 plus 1. That would be unusual, but it's not impossible. It's more likely that you'll have a body of sort of a majority of both sides.
And would you also agree that private leadership that wants a solution from this committee, they don't want to have this thing fail?
They don't want it to fail because they don't want to be pegged as the ones who caused it to fail.
Right. Yeah.
They don't want the fallback automatic.
They don't want the trigger.
They don't want the trigger. No, that's right.
To go in. And they don't want the potential market reaction.
Right.
But I think
So you could get a big market reaction. Right.
There's some powerful reasons to want.
Well, you know, the funny thing about it is, you know, the word is right now is that Speaker Boehner is actually going to his leadership and telling him, look, get on board with this, because anything is better than the trigger. We pull this trigger, we're all out of jobs. And is that an accurate message going forward? Is Speaker Boehner pulling the right message?
Well, remember, we don't know the details, and Boehner doesn't know them either. What Boehner is saying to his people is there are aspects, if they come up with a deal and we're rooting for one, there are going to be things in it you do not like. Get yourself ready for that. And realize that what you see as a flawed solution may be better than no solution. Start getting ready.
Congressman, now, does it appear right now, with everything that we're hearing, or on the other hand, not hearing, out of the Super Committee, do you think that the members of the Super Committee may be telling themselves individually, we may be falling on our own sword for this?
Well, I've been waiting for somebody who was willing to fall on their sword for this. The fact is, for example, if you go back and look at my voting record on appropriations for the military, you would think that I was the world's greatest peacenik. The fact is, I think we now have to be very careful how we cut defense for a couple of reasons. One, thanks to Secretary Gates, who basically volunteered a sizable set of cuts that he thought were responsible to go along. The only other way to make massive cuts is to get a time machine and go back and not go into the Iraq War. My point is, I think that as a Democrat, that we've got to be very careful about making deep cuts in defense, because we've committed ourselves, whether we happen to agree it was a good thing or a bad thing to do. Nevertheless, we did it. We got to live with it. We got to pay for it. And being reckless in cutting into defense could be a very, very bad mistake.
Okay. Bob.
And picking up what Al just said, that shows you the difficulty of the problem that the committee faces. Because there, we all can imagine that a number of the Democrats on there are looking at defense cuts because they want to cut some of the what they consider waste in the Defense Department. And you've got Republicans over there who, every nickel you take out of the Defense Department, they want to make sure it's justified. On the other hand, you've got changes in the entitlements that the Republicans are prepared to make, which are anathema to the Democrats. To go back to something Alan said, and I said earlier, what's amazing right now is that all the members are working together to make sure that nothing leaks that in effect is a big cut one way or another. It seems to me that the most important thing going on right now is everybody's keeping their mouths quiet and they're working behind the scenes. And the only thing that comes out of it is a chairman or the vice chairman making a bland statement about, you know, making progress.
Right.
It's a very good sign.
Well, Chuck, let me ask you a question. Is there any possibility that the super committee might come outside the box and surprise everybody and saying, look, not only have we found the cuts, but we're also going to implement some other recommendations. For example, one of the ideas being batted around is means testing Social Security. One of the other questions is upping the retirement age or coming up with a new funding stream. Could the super committee actually come out under their authority and say, look, we're also suggesting this?
Yeah, they could, but
is it possible?
But I don't think it's too probable.
Really?
Yeah.
Why not? Why wouldn't they not take
because
the opportunity?
Because in Social Security, anything you do doesn't get you immediate savings. It gets you savings in the out years, which is a good thing.
Right.
But I think Social Security will be dealt with separately and will not be part of this big solution here. I think it's going to be the health care area and the defense and the discretionary. You got three pots of expenses. That will be the key.
Do you think that they may come outside the box and maybe recommend new funding streams?
I think that'll come later. I think the tax code revisions and the new funding streams, like maybe a VAT tax or something like that, will all be done sometime in the future.
You don't think that they'll come out and say make a recommendation, perhaps?
I don't think so.
Alan?
If they do, I think what you would expect as Chuck says, this stuff is really complicated. It's not just difficult from a political standpoint.
Yeah.
It's very complicated to start fiddling around with, for example, Social Security benefits and Medicare benefits and the taxes to pay for them. The tax code is very complicated. What they could do is say, okay, we are instructing the Finance Committee and the Ways and Means Committee, the two tax writing committees of both houses, to, within the next 6 months, propose something jointly that would generate X amount in new revenue. They could do that with Social Security. They could do that with Medicare. So they could create the framework in which you kick it back to the regular committees of the Congress and with a tight timetable require them to act. It's almost like another special committee arrangement on top of the super committee. That's a possibility that does offer some potential for moving beyond the 1.2 to 1.5 figure.
Now, Congressman Al, we've talked on this show many times about Simpson Bowles. Or would it be in the committee's interest to maybe roadmap their cuts to a well-received document or recommendation like Simpson-Bowles? Or are they just going to say, we're doing this on a clean slate?
You really have to know what it is they're doing in order to be able to give an answer. If they have figured out a situation of their own that they think will do it, they're probably going to stick with it. If they ultimately get to a point where they can't come up with something of their own, Simpson Bowles would seem to be one of the few things left for them to do.
Chuck, I pose that question to you from the Republican side. Is that something that they're going to roadmap back to? Could they roadmap back to?
I think that's a possibility. Yeah, they really do. What's been discussed here, these are possibilities now.
Bottom line here is when we talk about the super committee, and I'm going to pose this before we go to break. Will the super committee reach a deal, Congressman Al?
You would ask me that.
I'm going to ask everybody that question. Well, I happen to be going John McLaughlin on you.
I'm an optimist, and I'm going to say that finally some common sense will settle on the Capitol, at least enough so that they can come up with something.
Alan.
I think they will. They'll come up with at least 1.2 and about a 50-50 chance of doing the 1.5 or more.
Bob.
I feel the same way.
Chuck.
Yeah, I think so, but it also would never surprise me that some people keep their feet in concrete at the end and that doesn't quite make it.
I think they will do a deal. I think they'll go on the high side, $1.5 trillion. I think that number will be floating around a lot more closer we get to November, the end of November. Subtle. Very subtle, Alan.
But also,
very subtle.
Also,
Bob.
We also remember this. Their deadline for reporting is the
23rd of November, correct. Yeah.
Remind yourself that in order for them to get to the 23rd with something that is cleared, they're going to have to finish it probably at least 10 days to 2 weeks earlier so that the CBO can go through it and certify that it's got its number met. If it's going to be a close question, if it reaches 1.2, which they have to do, they've got to have some time, and they've really got less than a month to reach their agreement.
Congressman Allen, I'll give you the last word.
Bob is absolutely correct, but I just wanted to go back and point out that of the four of us who made projections, the one of us who knew the most about it was the most pessimistic. That is a sobering.
when we come back, we're going to talk about the line in the sand. Wall Street's running a line in the sand with the Democratic Party, either back us or back the Occupy Wall Street protesters. You cannot have it both ways. Basically, don't enjoy the cake too much. This is Backroom Politics live from the Bourbon Room in Chili's Back Room in Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us. Thank you. There is. And we're back on the air live from Chili's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. Just a shout out real quick. If you are in the National Capital Region, you happen to be downtown, leaving a meeting from the White House, Chili's Backroom tonight is having a joint function with the Whiskey Society. They are having a cigar and whiskey pairing with Jameson, Wild Turkey, Glenlivet. That is tonight from 5:30 to 9:30 here at Chili's Backroom. Ted Cigars, which recently got a rating of 88 by Cigar Aficionado, they will be sponsoring this as well. So if you're in the area, come on down, have a cigar, have a scotch, enjoy it. That's here at Chili's Backroom, the heart of Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. Let's go back now to our next subject. We're going to talk a little bit about a little bit of the infighting going on between Wall Street and the White House, and actually the DNC as a whole, or the DNC as a whole. The word is now on the street that apparently the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, sent an email urging supporters to sign a petition backing the Occupy Wall Street protest. This apparently did not bode well with leadership on Wall Street. They have now come back and said, hey, wait a minute, you cannot massage the anti-corporate Occupy Wall Street rhetoric and then still expect us. By the way, President Barack Obama, you got more Wall Street money than any other president in history. You might want to think about biting the hand that feeds you. The big question now comes up is, can the Democrats, in fact, get it both ways? Can they play both sides of the fence? Al?
Well, I think their problem has been that they've been trying. I think it's about time that they choose sides. And I would choose sides with the people who are concerned about Wall Street rather than the other way around. I would remind you that when the Tea Party first began, they had a rally up on Capitol Hill, and you had congressmen coming out on the balcony of the Capitol, urging them on and starting chants and what have you. So, the precedent has been set. And why Wall Street thinks that the Democrats should rationally support them, who, for all intents and purposes, have caused all this problem to begin with, is beyond my comprehension.
But, Chuck, when we see the relationship that the Obama—I mean, let's be honest—the president surrounded himself with Wall Street people. Tim Geithner, Secretary of Treasury, big Wall Street player. Ben Bernanke was a big player on Wall Street prior to taking over the Fed. Can the president and the Democratic Party as a whole back itself out of its ties with Wall Street and back the protests that are going on in Lower Manhattan?
The issue you raise is a very tough one for him, because when he went with the Rubin team, which he went with instead of Paul Volcker, which I think might have been a better choice, it's hard for him to do that when all his top economic advisors are from the Wall Street. And that's what one of the issues, I think, is the people in the 10th city are out there mad about.
But, I mean, Alan, we look at, the people that are involved in the protests in Occupy Wall Street. Along with being disorganized, along with not having a common message, the press has kind of done a good job of kind of painting them into their own policy of, look, we get it, you're against corporate profiteering, you're against corporate mongering inside government, but at the same time, the Democratic Party is hitting a lot of the liberal moneymakers in Lower Manhattan that tend to give a lot of money to the party. Is this a matter of, do I risk campaign funding and go with the people, or are the people just going to have to sit there and go, well, we'll put on a show a little bit?
I think this is a dangerous dance that they are in. Not surprisingly, because people say, wait a minute, you cannot trash us and then come back to us tomorrow and ask for our money. That's not going to work. Fine, not a big, they can sort that out. They're trying to have their cake and eat it too. Probably not going to work out quite like that. the thing that bothers me about this messaging, though, is, and we've talked about it a little bit in the past, when the president himself demonizes millionaires and billionaires without defining what he means, are we talking assets or income, and by demonizing everybody, not just the people who pay next to no income taxes, but those who also pay 40 to 50% of their income in taxes and who give a lot of money away, you run the risk of turning a lot of people off who are your willing supporters, and you play on people's ignorance, the public, who then starts thinking they're all cheats. Every wealthy person cheats, and you have a lot of risk of reaction that can feed to hanging an effigy and potentially violence. When they say, let's go march on somebody's house in Upper Manhattan, I think that's not something you want to encourage from the White House, and that bothers me a lot.
Congressman Al, you kind of winced a little bit during Alan's thought there.
Look, I think the Democrats have been buffaloed by the Republican Party ever since Ronald Reagan. Pardon?
Why?
Why? Because they haven't got any guts. I mean, Reagan was so enormously successful that they were afraid to really take him on. And they still continue to try and say, we're just kind of more liberal Republicans, is what I think they're saying. And that's nonsense. They're not getting anywhere with it. This is not doing them any good. And I think they need to revert, if you will, to their traditional position of being for the middle class, for the working class, and not as the handmaidens of Wall Street.
Now, and Chuck, I want to go to you for this question. Now, in disclosure, you did serve on the board of the National Association of Security Dealers, right, which was the oversight group over NASDAQ, which right, also involved a lot of these investment banking houses. Now, that being disclosed, we saw the economic impact that Lehman Brothers going out of business, the number of unemployed people in lower Manhattan was staggering. And yet we see people, it's almost like, well, you can't make profits. Well, if we don't make profits, we don't work. Is there a certain hypocrisy of saying create more jobs, yet you can't make profits?
Well, I don't think they're saying that you can't make profits. What they're really concerned about is when the top people of the banks never hardly took any less income with these huge bonuses as soon as they got bailed out by the taxpayers. Why they went right on and started financing the hedge fund guys again, and life went on as usual in Wall Street, where the rest of the country started to hurt. So I don't think they're necessarily against profits. It's maybe what they're against is, how about let everybody make some profits rather than just a few at the time?
Well, I mean, but we are Bob, go ahead. I was going to say, we are seeing the fact that, you know, I mean, the people who work at Lehman Brothers,
yeah,
or whether it's Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley or Chase, you know, the people who work on Wall Street tend to reside in areas where their income tends to be ripple effect. They live in Westchester. They support the grocery stores, the mom and pop hardware stores in Mount Kisco. There seems to be the lack of vision on the Occupy Wall Street protesters that say, hey, it's not that they're just keeping it and hoarding the money. They're actually spending the money and helping drive the economic engine. Is that an accurate portrayal, or are we somewhat misguided in that vision?
I think it's not a totally accurate portrayal, because what they're doing is sweeping that money all over the country. Everybody goes in and makes their deposit at the local bank branch. In the old days, it was a local bank. Now, most of the time, it's a branch of one of the four or five big banks. We've never had such big banks control so much money. And they get swept into New York, and they're funding the hedge fund guys, and they're funding the proprietary trading and everything like that. And so is the guy in Indiana, like my hometown of Elkhart, Indiana, got a fair chance to get a loan for his small business, or somebody that wants to get a mortgage and everything like that? So that's what the country senses, that the inner group is taking care of themselves, and it isn't that they're spending their money at the local shop. Sure, in Westchester, you know, but you got a lot of people in this country living in small towns, and they would like to see a little more liquidity and credit and everything like that in their business.
Congressman Al, I go to you. You know, the furthest possible way, other than going to Florida, the furthest possible area that you could get to is your old congressional district up in Washington State or Washington Second District, far less than Hawaii. But when you look at what you're seeing out of the Occupy Wall Street protesters, does that message, do you think the 99% message, that message resonate with maybe the folks out in your neck of the woods, out in the old Washington Second?
In with the Boeing workers? You bet. Middle class and the working class everywhere, including in the Pacific Northwest, I think, feel that they have been ill dealt with in this whole process. These guys started the problem, and then the government bailed them out of the problem, and then, as Chuck said, they swept as much money off the table as they could into their own pockets, and won't spend the rest to stimulate the economy. Why shouldn't the middle class Americans be thoroughly angry with them?
But Alan, we also have to look at the fact that, I mean, the president really is, as you said, playing a really dicey game of chance when he's playing with this. You know, these large banks are employers. They employ the janitorial services that clean the building. They employ temporary workers in many instances. You know, is the message just centralized? Is this regional? Will people in Indiana perhaps adopt this and say, hey, I'm part of the 99%?
You know, we talked last week about the group that's right two blocks from here, here in D.C., they're all over the lot in what their main issue is. There's a huge thread of anti-war folks here. There's some environmental protection folks, and then this major strain of resentment at the fact that there is high unemployment, high level of foreclosures, a lot of people with mortgages underwater, a lot of people uncertain about meeting family needs for education and health care, and there's still a bunch of rich people. I don't think it's as much, maybe on Wall Street it is, because it's Occupy Wall Street and we can talk about big banks. I think there's a resentment all over the country that's not aimed at Wall Street per se. It's aimed at wealthy people who don't appear to have suffered the extent to which poor people have. The irony is, a lot of rich people have lost an enormous amount of money. It's just that they still have a fair amount of money, and they're not desperate and worried about losing their home. The Bank of America, we can talk about Bank of America. In the middle of the crash, Bank of America stock was selling for about $50 a share. You can get a share now for $6.50. A lot of that stock was held by senior people at Bank of America. Crocodile tears, too bad. Sorry, guys. My only point is that rich people lost a lot of money. They still have money. Poor people lost what money they had, and now they don't have a house, and they don't have a job, and they're fearful. And I think we got to be very careful how much we demonize the people who still have money, because we're going to rely on them. Not Wall Street, not the bankers, but in communities all over the country. You don't want the locals to start turning on the folks in the big houses who happen to be the local bankers, the local business owners, even though there's resentment aimed at them. We got to work together on this to pull us out.
Congressman Al, go ahead.
And here's where getting back to the argument that you were trying to make as to whether the Obama should worry about the fundraising. I think he's got to choose. He could provide the direction for this group. We say that they're kind of aimless and whatever. I think that's true. But he could provide the direction for them. And in doing so, he's going to give up a lot of money that he hasn't already cleaned up out of Wall Street.
Well, it's already being reported right now that...
And I'd make the point that I think he probably would be smart to do so, because he's going to, you know... You raise money to, in effect, buy votes, to not literally, but through advertising and all that, you buy votes. But you can also get votes other ways, and he needs to start seeing what strength the...
Bob!
What Al is saying is very interesting, and as I'm listening to it, I'm thinking to myself, yeah, he can harness this group, but can he control it?
Well, can anybody control...
I don't know, but I mean, my point is this is a pretty dangerous thing. I mean, he's basically throwing a lot of red meat into people who are hungry.
He's controlling
the Tea Party.
The Tea Party.
Yeah. Nobody is.
Nobody.
And look how... Yeah.
Hold on. Bob.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point. I mean, look at the problem that the Republican leadership is having in controlling their own people who are elected officials. These people are hurting people, and they might go anywhere.
Congressman Al.
And the Democrats are sitting around with their thumbs in their mouth wondering what to do. I think that you've got an obvious thing to do, and get in there and play the same game the Republicans
are. Alan.
First of all, I don't know how big this thing can ever get. The Tea Party overwhelmed us with the depth and breadth and numbers that came out. I don't see this happening. I also see this as a group that's much more disjointed. A lot of these people hate Obama and hate all politicians and hate anybody with money. They hate Obama's wars. They hate Obama's economy. They hate Republicans more. They hate rich people more. I don't think this is a group that you can necessarily go and recruit and say, come on, guys, follow me.
Hold that thought. We're at the top of the hour. By the way, it's now happy hour here at Backroom Politics. It's time for us to order the martinis, the wines, the beers, and the scotch as we go around the table. We're going to take a three-minute...
And the refills.
And the refills. We're going to take a three-minute break, make our orders, light up another cigar, and we will be back. We're going to continue this discussion on Wall Street versus the Democratic Party in about 3 minutes. Stay with us. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us.
Of the sun and west of the moon, we'll build a dream house of love.
We're back here live in Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. Joining us as they do every Tuesday, going around the horn, it is Congressman Al. It is the Honorable Alan Moore. Bob Hines is doing Bob Hines type stuff. He'll be back here in a second. And our special guest, former Comptroller of the United States, Charles Boucher. Thanks, Charlie. Chuck, thanks for being here with us. We're going to continue our discussion from last hour about the line in the sand that's being drawn between the Democratic Party and Wall Street right now.
I can't believe it.
I can't
believe that I am sitting here having a serious discussion in which somebody is surprised that the Democrats might not agree with Wall Street. My God, what is their sense of history?
Yeah, but here's the thing. Let me point out something here. And I'm going to direct a question at Chuck when I say this. Again, in 2008, President Obama, outraged by over $1 million, John McCain, from the finance, real estate, and basically the financial sector.
A lot more than a million.
Was it over a million? Okay. You are looking at an organization where Goldman Sachs employees, just Goldman Sachs, contributed more than $1 million to Obama in 2008. This year, Obama has raised $3.9 million from the finance industry, part of which was based on a series of fundraising dinner that was hosted by Warren Buffett in Manhattan. Now that the turn of the tables is, the big money winner out of Wall Street right now, Mitt Romney, they love Mitt. But it would strike me as odd that in 2008, a Democrat would be the big money winner from Wall Street fundraising.
Well, I'll give you the answer.
Go ahead, Chuck, please.
Yeah, when you saw McCain with no economic advisors of any strength, and there was Obama with Paul Volcker and that team of people, and like that, and all of a sudden it was the economic meltdown that was the big issue, and McCain called for that meeting at the White House and didn't say anything. The Wall Street guys got scared and gave the money to Obama, hoping that he was going to have a strong, and let's face it, they saved Wall Street.
Well, let's call them.
I mean, they got their money's worth by backing Obama.
Chuck,
well, there was TARP.
TARP, too big to fail.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But Chuck, let's ask the question, though.
Yeah.
Let's just put the ugly on the table.
Yeah.
Is Obama too connected to Wall Street?
Well, in the eyes of a lot of the middle class and working class, he is.
But what's the reality?
Well, the reality is you got to keep the banking system working. You don't want it to collapse like it did in 32.
But is surrounding himself with the likes of, I should be more respectful, with surrounding him with individuals like Geithner, Bernanke, that crowd, is that a smart move to continue the message of creating financial stability?
It gives them a problem, I think, with the middle class and the working class. I really do.
Yeah. Al, how does the president separate himself from Wall Street? Al, I said Congressman Al. I apologize.
Well, it seems to me that he's out on the road, he's on his bus, he's got audiences, and he needs to modify his message a little bit to start talking about the problems of the middle class and the working class. Now, whether that means he's got to demonize wealthy people or not, that would not be my first choice for a strategy.
Yeah.
But I think he needs to start saying, you know, these people got left behind, and we need to do something about the people who got left behind. And that kind of rhetoric, if that offends Wall Street, it doesn't surprise me.
But it's
a reasonable thing to do.
Who gets left behind? Bob?
Well, I'm not sure who gets left behind, but I think what is an example of where I think he's done the right thing. A month ago, his jobs program talked about raising taxes on everybody over $250,000 as a family. Today, he's talking about taxing people over $1 million. That plays right into the hands of where he's going, you know, with the alleys. You could talk about all the crowds up in front of Wall Street. I mean, that resonates with them like crazy. And it lets an awful lot of people who have reasonably good salaries but aren't making $1 million, they can have a little more relief in the sense that they're not about to get hit by a tax increase. And I think that was a pretty smart move on his part.
Alan.
Well, yeah, that wasn't his part. That was the move that the Senate Democrats made, because some of their guys were saying, oh, we're upsetting people with income, family incomes between $250 and $1 million.
I'm sure they were working together.
They started that.
Chuck, yeah. You were saying they sharpened it up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was right there. That the Senate guys, they didn't want to have the $250,000 crowd. They wanted the $1 million, and they bought Schumer and those guys thought that sharpened the issue. Yeah.
That's why we went from the 97% versus 3% to the 99%. But the fact of the matter is, the public doesn't know what anybody and the individual's income is. They know rich guys and big houses and big cars. That's where the danger is when you start demonizing the rich people and not distinguishing. There are some who pay enormous amounts of taxes and give a lot of money away, and others who are using the system. We got to make sure everybody pays.
But then we see Senator John Kerry from Massachusetts. He's quoted in the story in Politico by saying, he said, taking money from a group doesn't equate to supporting them. And this is a quote from Senator Kerry. Quote, it's what you fight for and how you vote. It's always how it's been. Unquote. It is hard to run for office and not have somebody in some sector or some industry have contributed to you. But the question is, are you voting commensurate and values and the interests of the people broadly? That sounds like, to me, riding the fence.
Well,
and that's why Kerry didn't get elected.
Everybody has to take money where they can find it. A lot of times you sort of take their dough, then you tell them no. You won't do what they want. That does not mean that you turn them into evil people. You do not demonize
Congressman
them.
Congressman
Al. I did exactly what he said for 16 years. I took their money and voted against them. But I did not demonize them. I see no reason you need to go out and bite somebody's nose. But I think you can talk about the people that are left behind. That's the positive spin on the same thing. That's not going to please Wall Street. They probably are going to give a lot less money to Obama. But I really do agree with Alan in a sense that demonizing takes you off into a very nasty area of politics where I prefer this election not go.
Chuck Bowden.
Yeah, I think one thing that surprises me is the president has picked up more of the details of what Warren Buffett is set up, because, see, a lot of people on Wall Street are only paying 15% taxes because of this carry trade arrangement that they have. And let me tell you, that it really does not fit well with the average taxpayer out there when they're paying 25 and 30%.
But let's be real about this. Is the Occupy Wall Street protest, it seems like this is just a result of more anxiety as opposed to functionality of the financial sectors. Alan, would you agree with that?
I need to understand the question better.
Let me clear it up. It seems that it's more based on rhetoric, hearsay, and scare tactics versus then what is the reality?
Well, I think that, as we've said, there's a lot of fear and anger out there, and here's a group of some thousands of people who've gathered and are saying, you know, to use the old phrase out of the old movie, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore, but they're not sure what it is they want. They hate the status quo. They hate the uncertainty. They hate what they've lost. And a lot of these people don't have jobs, so they can stay indefinitely. And that's the heart. The thing that intrigued me about the Tea Party is people took time off of their jobs and went over, and they were mad as hell too. I think there's some interesting, you know, connections or parallels with the Tea Party, but I think when that can be very overblown quite quickly. This is a group we still don't understand exactly who they are, how powerful a force this is, what it's going to do, and I think it's going to be a hard group to harness.
Congressman Al.
And what I'm saying is they're up for grabs. This is their hard people to harness. If you don't try to harness them, they sure as hell aren't going to get harnessed. And it seems to me that the president has a very good opportunity to begin to channel their concerns, particularly if he aims it at the middle class and the poor.
Bob,
I think all of us are basically talking about the same thing. This isn't a group. This is a whole bunch of different...
It's a coagulation of a bunch of people who happen to show up in Lower Manhattan.
It's not a group, but the president is one person who could lead it.
That's my point.
And that could be dangerous in a lot of ways.
Chuck.
Okay, I agree with this, because think back to the Vietnam protests. In other words, if LBJ had left Hubert Humphrey come out with a program like Mel Laird came out for, under Dick Nixon a few months later, after Nixon won the election, by saying, we're going to get out of Vietnam, and we're going to call it Vietnamization, and we're going to end the draft, Hubert Humphrey would have won the election because he had the people in the streets with him. But they wouldn't let him be free to do that. And so I think the Democrats are now facing a similar situation here, and that is, how do you harness the mood?
Alan, go ahead.
Yeah, I want to say, I just, this notion that the president could harness this, I just can't see it. I think this is a tiger by the tail the more he tries to hold on to it. Now, what I wanted to say, though, before was there's something interesting that's happened with Republicans. Early on, we all remember, we talked about it a couple weeks ago, Eric Cantor made the comment, and we all jumped on him by saying, these are angry mobs. He said it once, and he has backed off. And now he says, I made a mistake before. These people have legitimate concerns, and we need to pay attention to the concerns of the middle class. And I find that in some ways more interesting here, because I think that's really what this is about. Not, you know, sure, we can talk about his motives, not wanting to do further damage, whatever, but that's the reality. These are folks who are worried and scared and angry, and sure, you'd love to be able to harness that, Republicans or Democrats, but it's very hard to do right now in this environment, because they want so many such different things.
Well, you know, it's funny too, because when we see the interviews with the protesters, it ranges from everything from, I want the government to forgive my college loans, to I want the government to find me a job, to I want the government to give my house back after foreclosure. Stop the wars. The one thing in three of those four that I find is that there's a distinct lack of personal responsibility inherent to those discussions. There is, you did not have to buy that $500,000 home when you're only making $28,000 a year. The bank can give you the loan, whether it's, you have to make the decision that do you actually want to take on that loan. When you can go to the highest paying colleges in the world, if you can't pay that loan, then maybe a community college, which is a viable source of education, maybe community college is the route for you. There is an inherent lack of personal responsibility in all the demonstrators I've seen out of Occupy Wall Street. Al, you look like you're about to explode.
No, I wasn't. let me rethink what you said. Maybe I can work up an explosion.
Am I wrong in that observation? Congressman Al's got—he finally got exploded.
It's that if the president and the Democratic Party and Democratic candidates were to focus on trying to provide leadership and focus to these people, I think it's very possible that they could do that. And one of the reasons I believe it's possible is that as long as you don't have any leadership out here, you don't have any guidance to the media. The media is talking to all these people, and those are this guy's against the war, and this guy's against the pipeline, and this guy's against something else. If the political leadership started to hone a message, I think you would find our remarkably independent press would immediately begin to follow, and they would help put a focus on it.
Bob?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think, to your point, Justin, about the people who made mistakes, foolish or otherwise, telling them that is not going to solve any problems. I mean, you know, they made a mistake. Maybe they understand it emotionally inside. Maybe they don't. They're certainly not going to lay back. They're still going to complain. They're still going to be out in the streets. They're still going to be doing what they want to do. If they made a mistake, they don't care. They're still saying, you know, how come I'm in trouble and these guys in the big houses on the hill are doing just fine? And I think they are out.
Maybe they made better life choices.
Maybe they did. And maybe their father was the president of the bank, and so now they're the president. But the fact of the matter is, you're not gonna shake the you're not gonna get the people to go home who are in the streets just because they made a mistake.
But we also see a lot of the protesters that are walking around, they complain about corporate profiteering, and they're taking videos with their iPhones.
Yeah.
They're going to Starbucks to get their lattes before they go out and start protesting about profitability.
But that isn't going to...
Is this a great country or what?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there we are. This is what it is.
But let me throw out a suggestion, though. You know, if they were angry at the big banks, the quote-unquote too-big-to-fail banks, there are options. They could go to credit unions, put them into local banks, take that money into the banks that actually have the money. Congressman Al, go ahead.
We have two debates going on here. One debate is philosophical. The points you make are standard, conservative, and I'm not using that as a pejorative term at all.
Right.
A standard conservative attitude, but it's philosophical. Some of us are talking about the politics of it. The politics of how, in my case, I'm talking about how the Democrats can improve their chances of winning the next election. So we can both be right, but yours is theoretical, and I am trying to talk about winning an election.
But in response to that, though, I think that the theoretical, because of the fact that this organization is Occupy Wall Street or Occupy fill in the city blank here, is functioning is strictly philosophical, thus making it political. They're taking philosophical stances and making it political by saying President Obama is too close to Wall Street. Wall Street is too disconnected from the reality of the people.
Who is saying that?
You can go to any protester and look at any news media outlet, and they'll say the big banks are disconnected from the people.
So what is the solution to that?
There's multiple.
Get in front of the parade and lead it. That's what you do about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds like a winner. You gonna get in front of that parade?
I'll get in front of the parade and everybody will pay attention.
remember the parade at Animal Farm?
Yeah.
By the way, Bob. 5 points for the George Orwell reference on the show. Thank you for bringing out the literary portion.
But the president's in a position currently where he can shift into this very easily. He's on the road. He's on the bus. He's got the coverage. He can do it. Whether he has the vaguest glimmer of this possibility or not, I have no idea.
Chuck, I'm going to let you have the last word on this topic. Are the big banks, is the financial sector, are they the bad guys?
Well, they're the guys that have got through this thing in great shape, and the rest of the country is in bad shape. So that's the differentiation issue. And so I don't want to demonize the guys on Wall Street. But let me tell you, there's a high percentage of the American people that think those guys made out with our tax money. That every time they get their bank statement and they see they're getting nothing for their deposits, every time they get their 529 for their grandchildren, and there's been no increase, maybe a decrease. You know, in other words, they're
getting $5 charge on their credit card.
Yeah. Bob.
It's worse than Chuck says. Not only are they doing fine now, but they're the guys who got us into this trouble in a lot of ways,
right.
And they got bailed out. So they were doing fine. Then they got bailed out when they got in trouble of their own making because they didn't make good decisions about all these mortgages that were put together and all that kind
talking
of
stuff. Talking about personal responsibility.
So, and now they have basically got us into a mess. They were bailed out, and now they're taking the money and running to the bank. I mean, everybody's pissed off at that.
By the way, if this is not a reason to join a credit union, I don't know what is. I'm going to let that be.
I happen to be a member.
And I'm going to go down to SunTrust and go to my ATM and get charged the fee. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. When we come back, it's Tuesday. That means there's probably a debate going on in the Republican Party. We're going to talk about the movie auditions when we get back, and we're going to take it home with Tell Me a Story. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room in Washington, D.C. Stay with us. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Go down. That's got to make you happy as a Democrat.
Please stop laughing.
I'm going to have to start watching reality shows, I guess.
And by the way, Real Housewives of New Jersey got a bigger rating than the last Republican debate.
Is that right?
That's true.
And a whole bunch of other shows.
Almost anything gets a bigger number.
This has got to make you thrill.
Well, the whole Republican primary thrills me. We're going to end up with Romney, I suspect, and that troubles me because he is a very capable man who has inconstant principles, and I'm not talking about honesty and dishonesty, but he's liberal. I mean, he actually ran against Ted Kennedy saying he was more liberal than Ted Kennedy. You know, he did. Well, now he's
more conservative than that.
Yeah. But Chuck, I mean, you have to admit
he's the best candidate in terms of capability.
But Chuck, you've been around both parties.
Yeah.
You have to admit, though, I mean, there's an inherent responsibility for the governor, running for the governor of Rich Mansion in Massachusetts. He's going to have to play case that phase. Running nationwide for the GOP ticket, it's a whole different base. Do you fault Mitt Romney for playing his base in Massachusetts that's now, unfortunately, starting to come back to haunt him, and then seeing the type of candidate that Mitt Romney could be?
Yeah. Well, I think you can't flip-flop too much.
Right.
He's very close to doing it too much. I had all the candidates as clients in the 70s. When I was back at Arthur Anderson, between my Navy government job and being Comptroller General, I had the Republicans, the Democrats, everything, and the RNC, the DNC, both conventions, and everything like that. So I had a kind of a front row seat to watch this primary process, and I'm not sure the primary process that we have evolved to, which was started in 72 to give us more democratic approach to picking our leaders, is coming out with the best leader. In other words, and these debates now every week is I think a disaster for the party that has to go through it.
Well, that brings a good question. Alan, can the primary system, is the primary system as we know it now dying a slow and painful death?
I don't know if it's dying a slow and painful death. It maybe should die a slow and painful death, as Chuck is suggesting, because you remember in the old days, a group of long-time political leaders of the party would look at all the information available, get into a smoke-filled room like Shelley's back room, and make a judgment with their collective wisdom. Now, that generated a lot of angst and anxiety, and that's what caused the change. They say, how is that democratic? How is that transparent? And what we've got now is a system that gives disproportionate power to a handful of small early states. You have candidates like a Tim Pawlenty, a class guy, governor from Minnesota, who doesn't even make it to the first event because he is washed out in some of these early television debates. We still don't have the nominating system that we need in this country, and I don't know how we resolve it. I don't have an answer. Nobody's sort of pushing that. Having said that, the people who survived that process, it was Obama. It was ultimately Obama and Clinton this last time.
Yeah.
Two quality people. A lot of us sort of wish that it had been Clinton who had prevailed, but it didn't happen. No. I'm talking about on the primary side. It was those two. And on the Republican side, McCainerd, whatever one thought about him as a candidate and his ticket mate, he proved from 2.5 years ago and from years before that there is something to be said, that people do get better, and Mitt Romney is evidence of that. He's a much better, much stronger candidate today than having gone.
That same argument with John Kerry, that John Kerry should have been a better candidate than he actually was. He actually ended up not doing nearly as well as he should have,
well,
theoretically.
How about Al Gore?
Al Gore.
Yeah. Al Gore is running for president. He was vice president of the United States, and he was a disaster as a presidential candidate.
And he had a strong economy, and he had everything going for him.
But Bob, this does beg the question.
The ability to listen to anybody.
Right. And the lockbox thing did not help him at all either. The catchphrases were horrible. But can we actually blame the slow and painful demise of the primary system as we know it on the 24-hour news cycle? It seems that anybody who has any public... I'm surprised that Backroom Politics has not sponsored a Republican debate yet, which we may do in November.
Next Tuesday. They may all show up.
Yeah. if we have listenership, they'll show. Bob, is the 24-hour news cycle the death of the primary system as we know it?
No.
Why?
Why? Because there's a lot of other reasons. remind yourselves. The smoke-filled room that Alan talked about usually brought forth strong candidates from the party.
Yeah.
The people who sat in those smoke-filled rooms were the national chairman, major players, political players, elected officials, governors and senators, and the key players sat around tables and worked out who looked like the best candidate. Now, it's legitimate to say that was very undemocratic. The system we have today is much more democratic in many ways, but it is ridiculous when you look at it to say Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina are states that are what you would call mainstream states, let's call them. I mean, they're not. If you had a rule that said, and I'll just make it easy, the purple states, the states that are not blue and they're not red. If you had a rule that said the purple states are the only states that are allowed to have primaries, you'd probably have a different situation.
Right.
It would be interesting. The point is, there's never going to be, in a democracy, you're never going to get a system that is going to be foolproof, because people will always find a way to game the system. That's what we've done with the primary system.
Alan.
What's interesting this time, it seems to me, is that one of the many things that are interesting is that Republicans, even very conservative Republicans, are saying, let's make sure we end up with a winner this time. Let's not, even though it's been messy so far, let's not just pick the person who rings our own particular bell. Let's think about winning. Let's think about the strength of candidates. That's something new, and that's interesting. We'll see how this plays out, but it helps. That kind of thing helps Romney, because most people believe that Romney is the strongest candidate, and some of us think that Herman Cain is still having his 50 minutes of fame, but that ultimately his 999 is going to deep six his candidacy.
Bob,
what Alan is saying...
Great.
Oh.
What Alan is saying is an example, his conclusion is an example of why democracy eventually works. You know, the Tea Party, a year ago, if they had only been in office a few months, if the Tea Party was as dynamically committed to our way or the highway as they were the day they were elected, Romney would be having a lot more trouble than he has, because they would be so rigid. But everybody recognizes, and Alan is 100% right, people are, no matter what where they are on the 1-100 line of liberal to conservative within the Republican Party, they realize that they want to win.
But
they're beginning to see that it may well be that the most conservative candidates are not the ones who are going to win.
But here's the question: when we look at the line of candidates that we have right now, I mean, again, even some of the candidates, namely Herman Cain. If somebody went to Herman Cain a year ago and said, "Hey, by the way, you're going to be the front runner on the GOP ticket," even Herman Cain will tell you today he would have said, "You've been eating too much of my bad pizza."
But he's only been there a week. He's only been there a week. Give him another month. We have Bachman had a month.
Donald Trump had a month?
Maybe not.
And
Kerry had some time, and Romney has always been there, and it's beginning to look like the more conservative candidates each have their time, but they can't maintain the support.
Chuck, before we go to break, I want to ask you, is the sideshow that is the Republican debate right now, is that actually helping us get the message out, or is it convoluting everything?
Oh, I think it's confusing the issues. I don't think you're getting a good debate on the really major issues. In the budget, our economy, the war situation, these are the big issues that need to be resolved here successfully by the next administration. And I think it turns into more of a reality show.
Right. Yeah. Around the table, real quick, who has the most to lose tonight in the Republican debate? Al?
Well, Romney, being the frontrunner, always has the most to lose, and he has demonstrated an ability to avoid doing that.
Alan?
Kane.
Go ahead. Finish that.
He's hovering there, right up there in the lead. People are taking a closer look, and the closer you look at him and his ideas, the less you'll find.
Electrified border fence?
Electrified border fence.
Bob, who's got the most to lose tonight?
Kane, for the exact reasons that Alan said. He's out there. He's the one people are going to be looking at. There's been a good bit of talk about 999 and some other things. He's got the biggest problem. Can he sustain himself? I don't think he can.
Chuck?
I think the two front runners, Perry and Romney, have the most of the long term. I think Kane, for this one, could go down. But the other two, if they make a mistake, a big mistake in the long line,
we're coming up to the 15-minute mark till the end of the show. First of all, I want to take this opportunity, Chuck. Thank you very much for coming on Back to Politics. This has been one of the best shows we've had in a long time. You've been a great guest. I hope you'll come back and visit us from time to time. Hope you've had fun with this.
I've had a lot of fun. I'll certainly try and come back.
That'd be great. By the way, you bring us a lot of credibility, so we need that.
We're not used to people know what
you're
talking about.
That's right. The bar is pretty low here. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to close up shop. We're going to tell me a story. A couple of good stories, I think, that are floating around. Bob, you've got one that's hanging. We'll be back. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio, live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, the heart of our nation's capital. Join us in 3 minutes. And we're back live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. By the way, for those of you, we're going to close out the show, but it looks like we're getting a good crowd here. Joining us, Bob, the owner of Shelley's. Bob, tell us real quickly, what's going on with the event tonight?
Well, it's sponsored by the Whiskey Society, and essentially we're going to taste six different whiskeys. We're going to do two bourbons, two wild turkeys, two Glenlivets, and
a couple of Jamesons.
Two Jamesons, right. And we're packaging that with a Ted's Connecticut Shade cigar, which got the 88 aficionado.
Wow.
And we got a pretty attractive price on it. It's $40, including tax and tip.
Woo!
And we got Mike Goss here from Republic National Distributing, who's the dean of alcoholic beverages in D.C. And he's doing his little educational bit on the whiskeys. And we seem to have a pretty good following.
Good. Well, we invite everybody who's listening inside the Beltway. Come on by. It goes on until 9:30. So if you're in the area, come join us down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. Do it early.
There's plenty of time.
Oh, you can go straight to the place to be. Anyway, this is closing out the show. We're getting the last 10 minutes. This is my favorite part of the show. Tell me a story. Where we talk about hearsay, buzz, inside the Beltway, because we know everybody's listening to us. Something that we can trump the other news media outlets on, which we've done in the past. I'm going to start with you. Bob, sounds like you got a good one. Tell me a story.
The Trans-Canadian Pipeline has got the administration in a terrible bind.
Really?
Number one, the administration, like any administration, wants to see more petroleum, more oil, domestic or safe places, rather than coming from places like the Middle East. Number one. Number two, what started out as a relatively small bunch of folks in the Midwest, particularly in Nebraska, near where the Ogallala, underground water aquifer. As they've been concerned about it, suddenly it's turned out to be an environmentalist number one issue. So the president has got himself in a situation where the State Department, which is making the decision about whether to give them a permit or not to build a pipeline, because it's an international pipeline, it starts in Canada. They've been moving along the direction of approving it. Suddenly, a whole lot of the president's best supporters are going, they're very upset, very concerned, and they are doing everything they can to sabotage.
This could be the first time I have a follow-on to tell me the story. I am getting word right now out of my connections in Ottawa, the government capital of Canada. Word out of Ottawa is that this is going to cause a lot of tension between Ottawa and Washington.
Absolutely.
And Prime Minister Stephen Harper has been on the phone to President Obama on this exact subject, and it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Yes, it is.
And oh, by the way, Canada's got a more healthy economy, and they want to bring money down here. It's a tight rope. Alan Moore, tell me a story.
All right. Well, I earlier made the comment, in which I do believe, that for candidate Kane, his 999 is going to deep six his candidacy. So that's not my story.
What is your story?
My story is a piece of news from a Gallup poll released yesterday, which gives all of us hope. It's one of the greatest opportunities for unifying this country that I have heard about in years.
What is it?
For the first time ever, a majority of those polled favors the legalization of marijuana.
What?
50-46. Younger people more than older, liberal more than conservative, but no group has less than 35% support nationwide, 50-46. If we could take this to the Congress, groups that are sitting behind closed doors trying to work something out, pass a joint.
Yeah.
Then think about the opportunity for compromise.
Let's all get together.
Not to mention a few laughs and wonderful tastings.
Alan, can I tell you, I have to comment on this. I have to tell you, do you imagine this show if pot was legalized in this establishment? My God. You think I'm bad now?
It would be a lot
tireder and a lot hungrier.
Yeah.
And a lot happier.
Seniors are moving back to the future, particularly the younger baby boomers.
By the way, Alan Ward just ordered a bag of Doritos. He's got them on hand. Carson, how? Tell me a story.
I'm reading a biography of Louis Armstrong right now, who was a strong devotee of marijuana, and he may be rising up and playing a solo somewhere.
Wouldn't that be a treat?
That would be a treat.
Mine is this. I have laid out throughout this program a strategy that I think the president should take to co-opt the left wing demonstrators, and my prediction is he will not take it.
Really? I actually have a story today. The story is in today's Annapolis newspaper. We have talked about the gerrymandering going on in Maryland and the redistricting of the Maryland Congressional and State House districts. There's an article today in the Annapolis newspaper by Michael Collins, great guy, longtime Republican politico in Annapolis. Mike Collins' article is literally calling out the fact that Governor O'Malley was solely responsible for redistricting Maryland for an all-Democratic congressional delegation. This is going to backfire. This will backfire on Governor O'Malley and make certain that even though they may be small, they're ornery. The Republican Party in Maryland is about to take some real, real major steps in fighting the redistricting in Maryland. Mark my words. On behalf of the Honorable Bob Hines, the Honorable Alan Moore, Congressman Al Swift, I am Radio's Justin Thomas Russell, and I will be joining you along with our roundtable next Tuesday, 4 to 6. We will join you here at Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, for another round of Backroom Politics.
And I know you are going to move from where you're sitting about 30 feet up there where they're serving bourbon.
Oh, I'm getting some free scotch and some scars right now. That's why we're ending 2 minutes early. We'll see you next week on Blog Talk Radio. This is Justin Russell. Have a great week.
The place to be is Shelley's on Tuesday.
That's true. Have a good week, everybody.